And welcome to Unfrozen, Episode 4. This is Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing spectacularly. I am prepping for a conference for my day job, and it's all hands on deck, and the deck is looking conspicuously like the Titanic.
Well, you know, it's all a matter of reference there. So I think things I learned a year ago hosting a, you know, climate migration conference is that, you know, hold times when it comes to real estate and built environment are everything, because if your hold time for deck chairs in the Titanic had been, say, 2 hours, that could have been a very profitable time rearranging deck chairs in the Titanic. And so it's all about short term versus long term there. So, you know, so in the short term, maybe it'll come out fine. But you know, hopefully it won't be as dire as all that.
I hope you're right. And how are things in Montreal?
It's been a hard come down since we were in Italy, you know, drinking champagne at breakfast and bruschetta with speck every morning. That's what I remember there. I'm now, you know, sitting in my pantry with a blanket over my head and, you know, nursing a messed up shoulder. And, you know, yeah, just it's just back to life here. It seems Venice was but a dream, but so it goes in these times. So yeah, all in all, things are good, all things considered. At least, at the very least, I am not living in Charlie Munger's dorm at UC Santa Barbara.
Oh, my Lord.
I have seen daylight today, Dan. That's all I can tell you. And that's saying a lot here in Montreal, let me tell you, where, you know, my children are at school before the sun rises, and it's only November 4th.
Oh, Lord. I mean, when I saw that, I was kind of like, that pretty much... So basically, Charlie Munger is Mr. Burns. I mean, this is like something that you would make up for the episode of The Simpsons. It's like, yes, Smithers, it will be perfect because the students only want to look at their phones anyway. Now they'll have nothing else to look at.
Well, am I totally mistaken, or isn't Charlie Munger like Warren Buffett's right-hand man as well? So like, not only is he like Mr. Burns, but like he's Mr. Burns to like the permanent child that is Warren Buffett, who like drinks Coca-Colas and fizzy sodas and eats ice cream sundaes every day when he's not like fueling, you know, the coal rail infrastructure that will burn the planet to a cinder. So there's definitely all of that. And like, and Charlie Munger is unrepentant. For those listeners who have not caught up on this, Charlie Munger, billionaire, donation of $200 million to the University of California at Santa Barbara, the campus with like the most epic views and most beautiful landscape in the entire University of California system. And his gift of $200 million to build a dorm in a place where there's a massive housing crisis. I mean, basically Santa Barbara is a microcosm intensified of the California housing crisis, which is America's housing crisis. And they're going to build it, but they cannot accept any changes. And the man has turned in the equivalent of like a beehive for humanity with, you know, where 94% of the dorm rooms will not have natural light. And the language involved, and this is the part where I want to come back to, which makes my skin crawl, is about, you know, bringing the students together and unplanned encounters and hallways. And it's really any of us who ever believed in the notion of like the built environment to encourage serendipity, it's like having it thrown back in our face, like with like acid added to it. But Dan, it did not go over well. Architecture Twitter was not amused. And I believe UC Santa Barbara's like architectural, like, you know, critic/guardian quit over the whole thing too. Or, I mean, yeah, what's the whole story that you've seen?
Right. I mean, that's my recollection as well. And forgive me for just jumping right into my Mr. Burns impression. I'm practicing it all week without providing the necessary context.
It's all about context, Dan.
But apparently the Design Review Board, which usually is a pretty powerful organization on a campus, one of the chief advisors to that board, who is a principal, I believe, with now I forget the name of the firm. It's Leo Daly. He's a principal with Leo Daly, which is, you know, a corporate firm. I mean, and even this guy was like,
not sackcloth and ashes here. You know, this is, yeah. These are not saints.
He's like, I cannot, this will not stand. And, you know, it was presented, I guess, to the panel as a done deal. And I saw some commentary along the lines of, hey, you know, aren't there laws about this? Isn't there zoning? And the answer is yes, but they don't apply on university campuses. They have their own system and they can do whatever they want within the confines of that system. It doesn't have anything to do with the municipal code. I suppose that things like fire exiting and that and the like are probably exempt from that. But when it comes to, you know, I guess access to natural light and windows, they can do whatever they like.
No, I mean it's absolutely insane, and I think I started to mention there, $200 million gift. The total cost of this project, which would produce 4,500 student dorms, would be a cost of $1.5 billion, which I think someone pointed out would be $1,000 per square foot, which also just says everything about the cost of constructions in California. And you're right, like it's an accessibility nightmare. I believe one of the critics pointed out it would be the eighth densest neighborhood on the planet, equivalent to Dhaka. A lot of comparisons to Kowloon Walled City, in the former Hong Kong, which was the densest urban environment really of our lifetimes there. But the thing that really jumps out at me about the whole thing is again Munger's language about like why he wants to do this. An amateur architect who produced these plans himself. And if you look at the renderings, it's like they would create artificial daylighting and night lighting and like these student carrels and yeah, there's two access points to the entire dorm, which makes me think, Dan, I had this horrible realization that like that Charlie Munger is an avid reader of Tony Hsieh's Delivering Happiness, because this is exactly what Zappos did in their former suburban campus in Henderson, Nevada, where there was only one entrance and exit for like the entire campus, which was designed to flow all the employees through it. And this was before Tony got onto the downtown project and like his efforts to remake Las Vegas. But this is like a horrifying parody of this entire literature about like how do we like force, unplanned encounters between the students and all these sorts of things. And yeah, I don't know. Big sickening realization here that that he's taken it to the extreme, or maybe this was always a poison discourse, to say the least. But I don't know. But my favorite take on the entire thing, and there have been many architecture, Twitter came out for this, was Henry Graybar in Slate, who raised the real hot take of like maybe this is the best we can do now. Like in a world of late capitalism, where California can only solve its housing crisis at any level with like, with private donor money, maybe this is it. Maybe we don't get solutions in an orderly, systematic fashion. We just get the whims of billionaires doing that. I don't know. This is like an architecture problem though, right? Like the client gets what the client wants. Like, how would you solve this? Or like, is there a solution to this? Like, who talks the crazy old man off the ledge?
I think you just wait him out. The guy's 97.
Well, presumably he's got trust for this. I don't know if they get the $200 million if if God forbid something were to happen to Charlie Munger tomorrow, but
I mean, isn't there someone a little bit younger and crazier with more design sense, like, I don't know, Kanye, that they can turn to for this money?
Well, it's funny you say that, because we'll come later in a bit here to like what the crypto bros are up to on this front. But like, yes, Stan, I'm sure you can find somebody who will like loan you some Ethereum for this. But no, I think this is that there. But there is this larger point that like, yeah, like, the solutions are uneven and weird, and like you get mega dorms. I mean, it is bizarre also, like the fit between form and the fact that like, again, this beautiful natural landscape, would have no views whatsoever. And it's not Munger's first time doing this. I believe Harvard Westlake, the private school he's done buildings for and elsewhere. He seems to have a fetish, if that's not too strong a word, for designing private school or even just higher education, dormitories. So I don't
That look
know.
like jails and feel like jails.
That do, if someone pointed out that like, they would have to re if they didn't have the university zoning, I believe it was Billy Fleming at UPenn pointed out, they might have to rezone it as institutional slash prison, which really just says it all right there about what he's put up with them.
I mean, this is such rich, rich ground. I mean, for ironic observation, and tragedy, really, breeding tragedy. Because I mean,
Well, yeah, I mean,
what
shirt,
bitter irony.
Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire was another comparison that it was brought up there. Again, like, how does it, you can rezone anything you want, but how do you escape fire code is beyond me.
Absolutely. And I mean, like, okay, UCSB, where they had an incel who shot up the campus, it's like, do you want to create 4,000 incels? Because that's what you're going to get.
Well, or 4,000 incel shooters, or 4,000 casualties from incel shooters, because you basically have no escape
No
routes,
escape.
which is
How
very much
about
an
both?
American problem, I have to say, being here in Montreal, but it's a true one nonetheless. But yes, you're absolutely right.
And then even just the comparison to the fact that anyone would consider it a positive that it's compared to a cruise ship after everything we've just been through with COVID and cruise ships going around looking for places to dock because they were full of the infected. I mean, it's crazy.
Well,
It's
this
crazy.
that is a particularly a good point to pivot there, because not just any cruise ship, Dan, but Disney cruise ships was Charlie Munger's comparison. And that notion of the compressed, the small, the fantastical, escaping into other worlds is the perfect time to bring up the other big development since we last hung out, which is the metaverse. You know, and again, there's no way any of you listening could have escaped this, but in case you have, you know, Facebook has been talking about this for a while, and you know, it was about a week ago taping this. It happened while I was giving a talk to people about the future of cities, and literally I told them that Facebook ceased to exist while we were having this conversation, that Mark Zuckerberg announced formally the company would change its name to Meta, which will cause no one to forget the many lawsuits brought against it for, I don't know, you know, shaming teenage girls about their bodies on Instagram, or more likely just the outright ad fraud that they, you know, that they have perpetuated there, that the Texas Attorney General has brought forth in a lawsuit that's finally been unredacted. But they're going full-fledged into the metaverse. And by metaverse, I mean, you know, building a self-contained Facebook virtual reality world, which we can unpack here. But my favorite part of this, Dan, is not only, you know, can we imagine that, you know, Charlie Munger's students in his building will spend their days perhaps in a VR headset in the metaverse in their lightless dorms, but also, you know, they'll be preparing for their jobs in the future in the Microsoft metaverse, where PowerPoint and Word will await them in a virtual reality world. It's really amazing how the dystopia arrives very, very slowly and then all at once, don't you think?
That seems to be exactly what it is. And the other thing that, you know, going back to the Munger dorm for a second, that it reminded me of is the Worry-Free Company in Sorry to Bother You.
Absolutely right there. I mean, very on the nose, yes.
Like live inside your completely enclosed universe. We'll take care of everything, and you can never leave.
And we'll inject you full of like horse DNA here to turn you into our slave workforce, yes.
Yeah. I wish that movie had done better. I think a lot of people really needed to see that.
It is. It was a Boots Riley. It'll be remembered as a cult classic, and it is like one of the most truly fantastical, magical realist takedowns of, you know, late getting later capitalism for sure. But back to the metaverse. I'm curious your take on it, because I mean, I have lots of thoughts on this and working on several projects, and I know multiple interested parties thinking about like the implications of both, you know, potentially the Zuckerbergian metaverse, which is virtual reality focused, self-contained, like let's obliterate reality, or, right, you know, let's bring reality into that. And then there's the augmented reality metaverse, which I want to talk about too, which is the notion that like you're going to overlay data on the landscape. And Pokemon Go is really the starter gun for the potential, you know, benefits and dystopian side effects of that one too. But I don't know. I'm curious, like, you know, does Zuckerberg have a chance? I mean, it seems like the reaction against it was vocal and total, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I suppose that he could quietly transition into an entirely different, well, I don't know if he can really do anything quietly, come to think of it. But I mean, it seems like he's completely cashed in his chips with the concept of Facebook, and, you know, I don't think he's so naive that he thinks changing the name of the company is going to, you know, result in a giant public forgetting of everything that has come before. But I suppose if they start turning out products that people are actually interested in, the public memory will become shorter. And
yeah,
well, we'll get a shot at it, you know?
That part's hard, and no one can actually seem to do that. I mean, that comes back to me, you know, the metaverse, which as a design problem, particularly as a hardware design problem, it comes back to that. Can you actually build the killer piece of hardware? And you know, Oculus Rift, which they bought, you know, as their VR headset, is supposed to be that. It's not. Just like, you know, Google Glass wasn't it 10 years ago. Just like Snap Spectacles hasn't been it. They're investing heavily in the AR version of this. If I had to bet, you know, if anybody cracks this, it's going to be Apple, of course, with you know, supposedly with the Wayfarer size, you know, augmented reality glasses they're working on. But, you know, it reminds me of like of tablets, you know, before the iPad. You know, I mean, people forget this now because it's been a decade, but like people tried for almost 30 years to build tablet computers. Jerry Kaplan wrote a great book about this called Startup that was about the efforts in like the late 80s, early 90s to build tablet computing. And Moore's Law wasn't advanced enough to make it really feasible. And no one found use cases for it yet. The media ecosystem hadn't evolved. And by the time the iPad came around, you had both, you know, Moore's Law making it possible and YouTube existed. So therefore, like it became really a sort of streaming media screen anywhere you can take in the world. And that's what I think about like a lot of this stuff. Like, you know, until you solve the nausea problem, VR, will it happen or anything else? And, you know, I guess my point there is like also like, you know, metaverse, like base coin from the Neal Stephenson dystopian novel, let us not forget, you know, Snow Crash. You know, here it is trying to actually construct an actual, you know, virtual reality, complete and total environment. I was literally just watching, by the way, and then I'll stop because I'm about to like invoke like trigger, like safety words here. But I was literally watching a conversation between Yanis Varoufakis and Slavoj Žižek, actually, in Ljubljana.
Boy.
Yeah, I know, exactly here. And it's funny because Yanis was actually making a comparison of Facebook. This was before the announcement, but he was comparing Facebook to sort of post-capitalist, like that, you know, that it wasn't even about markets anymore. They just owned everything. And he said, as a thought experiment, imagine you walked outside from their lecture into Ljubljana and one person owned every single building in it. And not only, you know, there was no way to purchase anything. The person had the power to decide whether you could purchase, your rights to any part of the environment, et cetera, et cetera. And I realized, like, without even knowing it, he was describing exactly what it is that Zuckerberg wanted to build. So, you know, kudos to Yanis for that one, who has actually spent time hanging around gaming companies and in Seattle and actually knows what he's talking about in that regard. So there's that.
I mean, I do find this sort of interpolation between the physical impact of the let's call it the meta world, so that we're not confusing it with the metaverse branded product, you know, the virtual world, the Ethereum, the blockchain, the Bitcoin, and the huge environmental and physical impact that has in terms of data center real estate and the amount of, you know, energy that it consumes with these computers solving puzzles. And then you also look at, the efforts of these predominantly software companies trying to get into physical space. In the case of, you know, Uber's going to have their, you know, propeller copters. They're going to have their drone, you know, air taxis, and supposedly Apple's working on a car in some kind of skunk works in the middle of the night, you know. And then I just read that Google just invested $1 billion in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and is going to take their whole trading network into the cloud. And so what does it all mean? The convergence that's happening.
Well, good question. I mean, part of this, so it's funny you mentioned the trading network, because this is, again, Varoufakis has brought this up in his talk too, that, you know, that this is, you know, basically like they, like, the platforms are trying to eat capitalism, like they're trying to internalize it, which is a whole other scary development too. But I would say, well, what you're describing there, but, you know, kudos to Bren Bratton in his book, The Stack, which is like, you know, if any of you tried to read it, I tried and failed. I don't know if anyone, you know, it's like the joke from David Lynch's Dune, they tried and failed, they tried and died. That's how I felt about trying to read The Stack. But it was Bratton's attempt to basically describe, you know, computation as planetary all the way down. And like, yeah, and basically like, you, as you described, those software companies are producing hardware. And this is a whole other project I'm working on too. Like, this gets into the larger notions of where the city goes. And this is why, like, you know, the Facebook thing to me is slightly a sideshow. Like, I'm not sure it'll succeed, and I'm not sure it's that interesting, but it's the augmented reality version that terrifies me, because there won't be a metaverse, right? Like, you know, there's no totality of the internet anymore. There's competing massive feudal kingdoms with compatibility issues. Like, the notion, for example, is, as Zuckerberg was saying, that, you know, Facebook will allow their metaverse to be interoperable, is just like the completest joke available. There's no way to extract anything out of the Facebook platform unless you attempt, you know, to delete your account, which of course is impossible, and they allow you to do a complete download of your profile that you will then never consult again. So that's about it. But it's this augmented one that Pokemon Go pointed towards is the one that gets to me, because this is going to be the overlaying of data and services on nodes in the urban realm. And the stuff that's happening now is not like the smart city that we thought of 10 years ago. It's not about prestige real estate with like augmented digital services. These companies are like figuring out how to find weird interstitial places and add value to them in ways that like are opaque to us. And like, I go back, for example, to like when Pokemon Go happened in July 2016, like, when it was like a supernova, like exceeded Tinder as the most downloaded app ever. Like, I remember talking to a guy that weekend who was tweeting about his weird experiences. He lived in a deconsecrated church in Holyoke, Mass, which is one of the poorest cities in the state. And, you know, what he didn't know at the time and discovered later is that Niantic, which is the company that built it for Pokemon, had used maps and data and land records of places of worship as places to put the Pokemon gyms, which is where you go to train your Pokemon to basically dogfight. And so living in a deconsecrated church where the maps weren't aligned with the territory, that whole first weekend, like 40 or 50 cars a night would drive up to his property and park there with their engines idling, with their lights on, and they would drive away after a while. And he realized, because he was a software engineer and knew what was going on, they were basically sitting there training their Pokemon. And I remember asking him, like, so what are you going to do now? And he's like, well, the first thing I'm going to do when my neighbors come home tomorrow night is tell them I'm not a drug dealer. And then, but he raised the larger questions is like, what rights do I have when a software company completely overwrites the value and purposes of my property? Like, does it increase the value of my land? Does it decrease it? Like, what do we do then? And since then, Niantic had to, you know, take some measures there to, you know, put in buffers for companies that wanted to opt out. But like, but I think about this, you know, what will happen when there is a Harry Potter metaverse dropped on top of a Disney Plus metaverse, et cetera, where there are magical objects in one metaverse and not in another? And how do cities, you know, enforce, for example, the streets? How do you prevent people from wandering out into traffic? Because there's also a study that came out of Purdue University where, you know, some researchers there looked at traffic fatalities during the Pokemon Go craze. And then they, you know, they did a straight extrapolation from like quasi-rural Indiana to the entire country. And they estimated that like basically 250 people died and $7 billion in property damage happened because people either were distracted driving or walked out into traffic because of Pokemon. What happens when you take that to scale, right? And that's the thing that really freaks me out about the metaverse, the multiverse, as Marvel is training people to think about it on Disney Plus.
I thought the worst thing that could happen would be somebody follows Google Maps so religiously that they drive off a pier into a harbor, which did also happen.
No, the worst is, and like there's all sorts of great cases, is like, you know, chasing, you know, Pikachu out into the middle of a hurricane because, you know, Pokemon Go doesn't actually, you know, correspond with weather apps. So that happens too. But you're totally right about like, you know, the NFT space, because like that's definitely part of like the metaverse, right? Like this notion of like, you know, that we're all going to pay, you know, a million fiat dollars for, you know, for Ethereum avatars, NFTs, you know, that'll be our avatar on various things is exactly what they're trying to do now. And yeah, you know, Vitalik, and I forget his last name, Buterin, who is, of course, the creator of Ethereum, wrote recently a piece on crypto cities and the idea that, you know, looking at the various efforts by both cities that are real, Miami, of course, with Francis Suarez, Reno has created its own DAO. Eric Adams, the mayor-elect of New York, has just declared that he's going to take his first three paychecks in Bitcoin. I was going to say, someone, the best post on New York is like, the SFification of the world is totally happening. Like the governor of New York is like anti-density and the mayor of New York-elect is like basically wants to do Bitcoin. Like SF has totally mind colonized New York without them ever noticing. But there, you know, immediately pointed out that like, yeah, there's like the city DAO, like literally there's crypto bros who are out there going to try to build their own city from scratch and like create this. So I don't know, Dan, I'm curious, like your thoughts on like, maybe we can go about this all wrong. Like maybe we need to start a Discord, you know, get a DAO, like mint some NFTs and just go from there, like issue some tokens. I don't know. You think they'll have a better chance than previous developers? What could go wrong?
You know, it's entirely possible, especially if you think that, you know, the virtual is more fungible than the physical, which seems to be part of the conclusion, without acknowledging, as I said, all the physical infrastructure that's required to support that. But this actually gets me to thinking about another thing too, which is that have you seen the plans for Telosa?
Oh, yes. Mark Lorry. Yes. Tell our listeners about Telosa.
So Telosa is going to be a city from scratch that would be developed by a guy who used to run the e-commerce division at Walmart. And he wants to build a new city that in an unspecified location or locations, and that city would in theory be socially equitable as well as environmentally sustainable. Not to put too fine a point on it, that he wants to build something called the Equitism Tower as its centerpiece. And of course, none other than Bjarke Ingels is designing it.
Well, of course, yes. And I would say, I will shout out to Josh Brustein, my friend and former neighbor who wrote the cover story for Business Week about Telosa. So Josh, if you're listening, but no, I mean, my favorite part of this is, in addition to the awesomely cringeworthy scenes about Bjarke in that piece, is the fact that, like, you know, Mark Lorry, to his credit, is, you know, the only Instant City developer that I know of who's actually read Henry George and like wants to propose some like good old fashioned Georgist land taxes on there to do this. But yeah, the real crime closer to me, you know, and there's renderings, of course, of like autonomous vehicles and other fun stuff trundling down the street, is the fact that he wants to potentially build it in Nevada. I mean, I'm right. sure he could buy the water rights from somebody, but like, you're building a city from scratch in the century of climate change. You really want to start in Nevada? He has another proposed site that would be somewhere in Appalachia, which I'm okay. In that case, like now we're talking. Like, you want to try to do some sort of like billionaire led economic development in one of the poorest regions of the country. And, you know, even then, which is incredibly climate vulnerable, the New York Times, Christopher Slavelle did a great analysis of the fact that while, you know, a Maserati Joe Manchin, seeing he drives a Maserati Levante SUV, as it turns out.
Does he really?
Sunrise protesters cornered him, and it turns out he drives a Maserati SUV. The joke describes itself on so many levels there, like, right? Like buying like the most finicky, worse, like, you know, foreign SUV you can. Maybe it's some sop to Chrysler Group. I don't even know, but LOL, Avante. But as the New York Times pointed out, like, West Virginia is incredibly vulnerable to climate change too. Like, you know, they can't pull back from the waters without having to build on the hillsides, which are then vulnerable to landslides. Like, there's no managed retreat going on there. But even then, that would be a better primary. I mean, like, that's a place, of course, where, you know, and this is the dark joke there, is like, you know, once upon a time during the New Deal, you know, they built the Tennessee Valley Authority, and now, you know, maybe Mark Laurie will come here and build a private city from scratch. But you know, it could be worse. At least he wants to build it in, you know, under United States law and like some of the various startup cities and crypto cities that are out there.
That's true. It's not like a Freetopia or the city that's supposed to go up out that's been bandied about for probably decades now, on disused World War II silos off the coast of England.
Oh, I believe there's some of that there off Jersey, yeah, or Guernsey, you know, the notion of offshore there. I mean, I was thinking of this, you know, and maybe as a guest at some point in the future, we'll ask a Tusa Abrahamian to come on as a guest. She's, of course, wrote the whole book Cosmopolites on citizenship and is writing a book on these kinds of like free zones. I mean, the ultimate version of what we're talking about, Dan, also announced recently is like Jeff Bezos, like basically wants to build in low Earth orbit a mixed use business park, you know? At least that's how he sort of described it. I love that, like, the most, you know, mundane form of perhaps any kind of development is what he thought of first for space. But as Atusa, you know, mentioned in an essay she wrote recently, that, like, you know, that kind of, like, offshore export processing zone is, like, that's always sort of the first thing built, right? Like, you know, like, let's move the most polluting industries to space. Well, once upon a time, it was like, let's move them to, you know, Kentucky or Mississippi or Mexico or China, you know, and now we're moving them to space. You know, there's always an outside somewhere there. So you know, maybe that'll be it. You know, maybe the metaverse is that place. Maybe, you know, maybe a DAO is that place to do it. I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Ye brave pioneers of logistics.
It's all about logistics. Well, speaking of software, I'm curious your thoughts on this. The most interesting essay that I've read, you know, in the last week or so, was by Daniel Davis, and it was titled "CAD's Boring Future and Why It's Exciting." And, you know, you're as the real architect here between the two of us. I'd be curious your thoughts on this, because his overarching argument, and, you know, if we create some show notes for this, we'll leave it in the show notes, obviously, along with some other links to the fun stuff we discussed here. But his argument was that basically, like, CAD software developed as this incredibly horizontal software where, like, you could design, like, a wedding ring with it, and you could design, you know, an entire city from scratch with it. And he was pointing to, and I've got inklings of this as well, of, like, you know, like, you know, that instead of being really horizontal, the new generation of the software has become really vertical. Like, he was pointing at like Saltmine, which I've seen, and Canoa, which is some ex-WeWork guys. Basically sort of like a post-WeWork diaspora of like really advanced, you know, building information management systems that were designed to like solve very narrow problems, but do it really well. Like office layouts, like generate all sorts of like flex office layouts on the fly and other things like this. And I don't know, it struck me like that's sort of like the future where some of the software is going, that like, you know, it's cheap, it's hyper-flexible, and it's evolving to solve these narrower problems really well. And I don't know, and basically, its argument was that instead of trying to solve, as Bjarke has done and Frank Gehry did with CAD, what, a generation and a half ago, trying to create like, you know, hyper-unique structures like Patrick Schumacher's been trying to do with parametricism, like imagine the stuff gets applied to like just solving the more mundanity, the junk space, if you will, to borrow from Rem, of the world. And I don't know, I'm curious, like, as someone who actually had to, like, you know, get strapped into a chair and use CAD for 14 hours a day, like, you know, is that heaven or hell for you? What do you think?
Well, you know, to be honest, like, I was never much of a CAD jockey, and that's probably one of the reasons why I was the first to be let go when things were going more poorly for my architecture firm that I had joined, which had just opened up a branch office in LA, but their main cash cow was designing casinos such as the Paris. So they yeah, CAD really wasn't really my jam,
They couldn't
but
really sweat the asset as much as they needed to there, huh? In this case, the
they could
human
not.
asset.
And I was a more expensive graduate student, or graduate student graduate, if you will, than the undergrads who had been, slaving away amidships. So, yeah, but I mean, I think that the 3D, aspect is really, I mean, all that stuff, building management systems, BIM, all that stuff evolved because of the drawbacks of the 2D approach, which was basically, it was very difficult to resolve conflicts between the increasingly devolved members of design teams. So, you had your not just your structural and mechanical engineers, but people who, specialize in wiring and raised floors, and as buildings became more complex, they had to solve these multi-layered problems, and so they came up with these, 3D software to try to resolve, make sure that you aren't ramming, a rod through your heating duct.
Well, it's really interesting to put it that way, because that was really like that's what Davis calls out in his essay, and this is what I know from talking to like various alumni of WeWork that that got purged, is that the company's real technological legacy is the fact that because they were trying to like provision and deploy like millions and millions of square feet like all at once effectively as part of their hyper growth strategy, is that they actually did build entire systems from scratch to integrate all of those steps in a way that, as you described there, like, you described in 2D, but like CAD never really fully solved any of that either. Like there were other steps in the workflow. And so like they built vertically integrated workflow steps to try to deal with that sort of stuff. And now like now they're out in the world, like they're productizing it in a way. So I don't know. So I think it's interesting you saw that, because it was never fully solved by the digital tools, but like now there's like a step change maybe to hopefully sort of solve that stuff. So I don't know. That's something that I've been following, because like it strikes me as a real potential breakthrough there when it comes to the fact of like, that in a post-COVID world where, like, a clients want hyper flexibility. We're seeing all the stories about like, no firm wants to re-sign its old lease. They just want to keep things are like as flexible as possible. Like that's the kind of thing where like, if you're the building owner or even if you're a tenant, like, like figuring out like how much are you going to change on the fly? How much is the building owner going to change on the fly? All these sort of questions are up in the air. And so I don't know. It struck me as really interesting. Like shout out to Davis, who I did not know. I saw it on Twitter. But it struck me as like the best logical response I've seen to this in terms of like describing like how the software is evolving to sort of meet these needs. So I thought that was
And
interesting.
I mean, to put a little bit of a happier spin on this whole, metaverse monger discussion, that we're orbiting around our two poles today. One could imagine a totally immersive version of let's say BIM or CATIA or any of the sort of 3D design software where someone who is planning an office space or a windowless dorm, for the sake of argument, wants to know what it'd be really would be like to occupy that space, and then layer in all the systems and price out those systems and try to figure out the best configuration. What do they do? Maybe they just strap on a headset and with some guidance from hopefully a professional architect, hopefully there's something left for for them to do. They can say, well, instead of calling out and getting an estimate. And we'll come back to you in 3 weeks from our contractor. They're going to say, well, we'll just pull out of this menu, stick this piping system over here, stick this HVAC system over here. And by the way, we can put a window right there, but it'll cost you. And they could really feel the space, work the room, as Harvey Keitel said to Will Ferrell in the famous Blue Oyster Cult sketch on SNL when he ran around with the cowbell.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no. Other CADs are possible, Dan. And and other worlds are too. I guess one thing I want to leave with, since we're talking about like hopeful notes here, and we were talking about the metaverse. The other thing I've seen, the most remarkable object or media I've seen in the last few weeks, has been a video put out by Superflux. And if you know Superflux's work, Anab Jain, she's the front woman. I forget her partner's name. He was there, but like she's really the one who's, she's the one who gives the TED Talks. But they are like, they're basically like the best futures foresight design fiction agency out there. And they got a grant from, you know, from the Omidyar Foundation, founded by, I believe, Pierre Omidyar, who was one of the eBay billionaires. But it's called The Intersection, and it's, you know, it's their gorgeously rendered, you know, scripted by Tin Maan, who wrote Infinite Detail, imagining a sort of like collapsing version of, you know, of society. But then rather than just sort of end with a dystopia, because we can all sort of trace the strands of dystopia, it does sort of trace imagining like what a repurposed computing environment would look like and imagine like what other more utopian communities would look like. And it's, you know, it sort of takes it through it as, you know, there are other short films that I used to say were like the best examples of like what, you know, augmented reality landscapes would look like. And they show that at the outset of the dystopia, but like, but they get back to about like taking steps back and imagining like, how do we basically break free from some of the social media landscapes? And I won't spoil it for any of you. It's only 15 minutes long. So, you know, if you listen to this, we'll, again, we'll put it in the show notes, but just to say there, go to the-intersection.io and I'll throw that out there, but that's my pick of the week there, Dan. I don't know if you have one as well, but what would you leave our listeners with?
Well, I guess I would leave them with a little bit of tantalizing information I'm going to hear about in a few days' time, and I have to be a little bit careful because I've been involved in inviting these folks, and I don't know what they're going to say. But Sidewalk Labs are going to be coming fresh off of their Toronto experiment, which didn't go so well because of the citizenry's lack of interest in surveillance. But they are planning to do a mass timber prefabrication factory, and they're going to tell us all about it, I'm sure, under NDA on Monday. So I'm not sure what I'll be able to say about it, but maybe I can speak cryptographically and in code and get across some insights.
Interesting. Well, I said we'll resume that. We'll pick that up in episode 5 because I just became aware too of a housing startup that I know that's trying to basically build a modularized factory out in Colorado as well. So, you know, just as WeWork imploded and scattered its seeds in the universe, maybe yet another SoftBank investment, the, Katerra, which of course I think built multiple cross-laminated timber factories before it imploded into chapter 11 or 7 or whatever happened to, I think it's 11. We'll see what comes out of that. So, yes, I do remember, you know, if there's one takeaway that we had from Sidewalk Toronto, it was those gorgeous renderings by Thomas Heatherwick's studio. Always a weird, unexplored relationship there of the beautiful CLT towers they would have built there. So perhaps you can have this. Perhaps you can have the wood without, you know, the without the sensing landscape. So looking forward to see what you learn there.
Yeah, and then to put leaves on the tree, so to speak. The following day, we're trucking up to Milwaukee, which will surprisingly be the site of the world's almost next tallest timber building. It will definitely be the world's next tallest timber concrete high-rise building, a residential tower in Milwaukee of all places.
Really interesting. Well, I would say as a final note of factoid here is like he's a dude named Nolan Gray, who I think is a libertarian skewing urbanist on Twitter. I don't have his bona fides in front of me, but I think he might be George Mason affiliated. But anyway, he declared a bracket of best cities in America, 64 cities, and the finals are New York and Milwaukee. So
interesting.
As a former New Yorker, I would encourage you to go out there and vote for the Big Apple versus whatever, you know, unholy alliance of, you know, cheeseheads are out there. So obviously, I bring this up only because it's like front page news in Milwaukee that a Twitter rando has, you know, catapulted Milwaukee to the top of this bracket. They did defeat Austin. So, I mean, kudos to them. That was the first round. So,
and hey, you know, they've got the Deer District and Maders. It turns out some pretty great German food, and you can see a autographed photo of Gerald Ford, who dined there.
That's good to know. I've been to his presidential library in Grand Rapids. I had no idea that Gerald Ford just basically, you know, covered Lake Michigan from east to west with his presence. But there you are. So it's really his state. All right. Well, that's all I've got for you tonight. Here in frozen Montreal. We're unfrozen here, but today was the first day of the freeze. Winter has come here to Montreal. You know, it's one thing that's occurred to me in a sort of own dark way here that, you know, I've told the boys that, like, you know, that like when we were last year, we took a trip, and we're going to reprise it this year to Mont Megantic, which is a mountain which is ringed by smaller mountains in far eastern Quebec. And by far eastern, I mean near like the main border, but it's nowhere near any urban center. It's, you know, near the wilderness of Maine and Vermont. And so not only is it no cell phone service for at least 30 minutes from the park where we stayed, but also it's a darkness shed. Like, it has some of the best sort of starlight. And we were there. It's also because it's a bowl of mountains, it also gets incredible snowfall. And it just occurred to me at the time that, like, you know, that like winter, increasingly in the 21st century, will become like incredibly luxury. Like, you know, if we consider present trends extended, like access to winter in a warming world becomes this, you know, insane thing. It reminds me of the Ray Bradbury story. I forget the name of it, where it rained every day or rained all day, God, every year.
Yes.
And they lock the poor child in the closet and like the 30 minutes of sunshine and she's trapped in there. It'll be like that increasingly for the rest of the world, where, like, you know, like seeing that snowfall will become increasingly a rare luxury for people. And already happened in my lifetime in New York, where there are entire winters were only one or two snowfalls, heavy snowfalls. And children would have to go sledding in like the 2 inches of snow they would get for that entire year. Like, that could become the norm.
And that story like deeply traumatized me when I was a kid. They made like a cheesy TV movie of it, but it was,
I only saw the cheesy TV movie and had to go read the story later. Exactly.
Oh my God. Well, yeah. So I guess, you know, snowfall and stargazing are both going to become our fungible tokens that will no doubt become precious commodities.
Absolutely. I cannot wait to get the hash on that. And, you know, no one will. And if anyone steals my supposedly unstealable hash, I will just go crying to them that they should restore it to me, as happened to that bro with his, you know, bored ape. So that's another story here. But, you know, crypto living up to all of its promises.
I'm going to go look for my hard drive in the snow now.
There you go. All right. Well, on that note, let's wrap it up, Dan. It's a pleasure talking to you as always.